Jimmy, Jimmy Crane, Jimmy Crane's a nerd. Jimmy Crane's an improv nerd. Jimmy Crane's a nerd. Oh, Jimmy, Jimmy Crane, Jimmy Crane's a nerd. Jimmy Crane's an improv nerd. Jimmy Crane's a nerd.
Hey everybody, this is Jimmy Crane, and this is episode 55 of Improv Nerd. And this is a good one, I promise you. Sponsored by Hotel Lincoln, Chicago's coolest boutique hotel that's close to everything, including the Second City, that's both pet-friendly and improviser-friendly. You're not going to find that in many hotels. The Hotel Lincoln, the official hotel of Improv Nerd. Our guest today is the legendary improv group Beer Shark Mice. And I've known these guys when they first started in Chicago. And it is one of the most accomplished group of improvisers you're going to find. People like Neil Flynn from The Middle, he plays the father and he was on Scrubs. Pat Finn, he was on Ed, he was on The George Wendt Show, he's currently in Marvin Marvin. Pete Holney, who was on The Office, he was an Elf, No Ordinary Hero, a film he just released. Mike Coleman, you've seen his face in a million commercials. And Paul Valancourt, who is an amazing teacher and improviser. Now, Dave Koechner is also a member of the group from The Office and Anchorman, but he couldn't join us for this interview. So I would say that these guys are pretty accomplished. So we talked to them about their style of improvisation, how they came up with the form, how the form has evolved. We also talked a little about the TV and film business and what it's like to audition in Los Angeles. And one of my favorite parts of this interview is I get to ask Pat Finn, who's a longtime friend, and we used to be roommates, about this rumor that used to circulate in Chicago, because him and Chris Farley both started at the same time. They came down from Marquette University to study in Chicago. And the rumor used to be that Chris Farley stole some of Pat Finn's characters. So I get to ask Pat that, and he explains how he feels about it. Whenever I get to interview people that I started out with in Chicago, it's almost like I get to go back in time. It's like I get in a time machine and I get to relive those memories and those feelings. And I always feel a little sad when it's over. And when Pat was talking about Chris and his characters and stuff like that, I thought about, like, when I first started out doing improv, I said to myself, I don't do characters. Because I was scared, you know, and I hadn't found my voice. And since then, I found my voice. I've lost my voice. I found it and I lost it. I don't know where it is now. And I would tell, and I would say to people, I don't do characters. I don't do characters. But the truth of the matter is, for the first 10 years of my improvisation, I was doing a character. I was doing one character, and that was my best Bob Newhart impersonation. You know, the deadpan guy who reacted to all the craziness that was going around him. And I've heard comedians talk about this. Like when they first start out, you know, they'll take another comedian's voice until they find theirs. But I think in my case, I held on to that bad Bob Newhart impersonation for way too long. And I missed out on some great opportunities, not to become rich and famous or any of that, or a movie or TV part, but really on becoming a better improviser. Because I had convinced myself that I don't do characters. And not only that I don't do characters, but I thought if, you know, when I was doing the Herald, that if you brought out the same character that you did 2 weeks ago, that was cheating. And also, I think there was some jealousy. I was jealous, and I worked with some people that did great characters, like Pete Gardner and Dave Koechner. I was jealous that they could do such good characters, and I couldn't. And so it wasn't until I was 41 or 42 that I had the courage or the confidence to do characters in a show. Now, Tim O'Malley from Second City had written a one-man show based on his life called God Show, and he cast me in the show. And in that show, I had to play like 8 or 9 different characters. And they ranged from like a nervous doctor to this black woman. I got to play Martin DeMott, one of my improv teachers. I got to play God. I got to play a friend of mine, Rick Borelli. I mean, it was great. And when I look back at how hard I held on to that bad Bob Newhart impersonation, and in my mind, I was convinced this was the right way to improvise, and everybody was improvising wrong, and this was my road to fame and fortune, I realized that I was just afraid. I was terrified, and I was holding myself back. So, enough about me. Here's five guys that I've never seen hold themselves back. Beer Shark Mice. Enjoy this interview.
Jimmy's a nerd, he's a nerd, oh yeah. Jimmy's a nerd, he's a nerd, oh yeah. Jimmy's a nerd, he's a nerd, oh yeah. Jimmy's a nerd, he's a nerd.
Neil is assigning a seat.
Now, Neil, are you the most controlling of the group?
Can I say something first?
You please!
No. See what I did? No, I'm not controlling at all.
Okay. Can you tell us, Neil, how the five of you first all met?
I don't know. The five of us, plus Dave Koechner is normally among us. He is not today because she's shooting a fancy movie.
Anchorman 2.
Atlanta.
Yeah.
Is that what it's called?
Yeah.
If I'm not involved, I don't. I learn nothing about it.
Which is actually true about you. Is that right?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
If it's not my project,
you don't care.
It does not factor into my thinking. For the most part, I think we all knew each other in Chicago to varying degrees, and then at one point. Out here, I'm going to credit Pete Holney, the president of Beer Shark Mice.
Thank you.
Deciding that we should start, because IO West was just beginning out here. This is like 98, 99. And he threw a group together, and we had, and the group remains. Paul joined us probably 5 years ago, is that what it is?
More than that.
It's amazing how fast time goes by. But yeah, because we started, this is like 10 or 12 years
ago. Kennedy year.
Like four kids ago.
Yeah, the Kennedy years, yeah. So Paul's been with us the longest.
Now, Pete, you came up with the form. It's called the Slacker, if I'm not mistaken. Tell us about the form, because I've seen you guys many times tonight. I never thought there was a form.
Pete's smart enough to say he'd not come up.
Yeah, I didn't. Okay. I mean, we all talked about it when we were goofing around. I always liked to be physical, and so my whole thing was, what happens when people leave scenes? And I was like, well, what happens if two of us, if Pat and I are in the middle of a scene, and he leaves as the butcher, and he's upset with his wife, and I'm playing the wife, and the butcher leaves, well, where does the butcher go? Into his car? Does he go back to his butcher shop? So what we were trying to establish was that all of a sudden Mike would come in and be a customer at the butcher shop right away. As soon as anybody was leaving, entering, or exiting, you had to follow the person entering and exiting. And that's where the Slacker format came from. And we tried it, and what happened was that it would stifle the improv creativity because it just seemed to like constantly run, and you never had really established the scene, and then your transitions were basically waiting for someone to leave or waiting for somebody to enter. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I forgot about that.
So that was when we were all rehearsing in Koechner's house because he was the first one to buy a house out of all of us. Didn't he have a house? No, you had one. Maybe.
I probably have two or three. I was improvising. I was
Improv equals
riches.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah. Improv your way to income property.
Exactly.
Now, Pat, so this form evolved. And I knew and worked with all of you guys in Chicago. And if you see Beer Shark Mice, it really moves fast.
Yeah.
Now, is that because you're out in L.A., or is that a generational thing?
No, that's a great question. It's actually probably twofold. Because, in Chicago, they will give you more. They'll let you have more slack. I mean, they'll kind of let you have a scene that goes longer and longer, and they won't be like, what's going on? This isn't stand up. But out in L.A., I think it is a little bit faster pace, and it just kind of became the pace that we had. And whether we do it here or Chicago, it remains the same, but it's definitely a pace that we felt that, in the beginning, we felt like we were hitting with like a lull in the middle, and so now we try to, as best we can, have energy wherever we can do it to just kind of spike it.
Yeah, you don't mean to... You're not saying it's a regional thing that like the LA style of improv is faster and less patient.
I think I get the feeling personally that in Chicago they will let you and I can do a scene and it would last.
Do you mean the audience?
Yeah.
I think because they're a little bit more improv, savvier than out here, but like improv.
You and I can do a scene where we're having a campfire and not say a word for 2 or 3 minutes in Chicago.
And nobody's coming in.
No, nobody's freaking out, and the audience isn't freaking out. But here it doesn't seem like they give you that.
It's very likely true, and I know that we years ago, 10 years ago, we did something in New York, and I know Dave Pasquazi was there and was surprised and uncomfortable by how fast we were going. His and he in particular, I think he and TJ show in Chicago. They
it's
go
very slow.
Yes. And I'm sure that's great. I'm all for that. But I know that he felt our thing was not his thing of going so fast.
Right.
But I don't. What I think is that this could be just me. But because our style came from what Pete was talking about, as far as waiting for someone to exit before you could initiate an edit and follow that person, we just became, we found that it just, edits can happen at any moment.
Yeah.
We tend to, almost like, well, sometimes when this scene peaks, but almost before it peaks, just while it's going out, as soon as there's an opening, or maybe the second or third time there's an opening to possibly edit it, that we just, for me, I think it's almost like you can't resist just spinning the ball a different way.
Right. Yeah, I think it's all, if I could, I think it's also a function of the fact that the predominant edit of the piece is tag outs. So you're like, so
when
if you're doing like your hair, where you're doing sweeps, you sweep it, and then another scene sort of ramps up. Right? If you're doing a tag out, you're basically ripping off of the last idea that just happened. Like, I cannot believe that guy sold me this terrible car. Tag to that. So you already know all the setup is done. And you get to, it's less valleys and more peaks, almost all peaks or close to peaks. And I think that keeps the energy up and keeps going rapid, 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 where if it sweeps, like I know when we get sort of deep into the piece and we sort of have done a bunch of stuff and we're like, oh, we've really reached the end of that road, we'll sweep. And the energy's like, and then it has to ramp up again, you know? And I think because it's so many tag outs, I think that really makes a difference too.
And we didn't used to sweep.
No,
for people that may or may not know what sweeping is, it's like sweeping the entire scene and everything.
Clearing the slate.
Clearing the slate, watching the chalkboard, and starting over and writing your...
And maybe that was used because the scene had hit such a crescendo or such an apex that it was like, we got to get these guys out of here kind of thing.
Well, if you get to so high of a scene where it's like all of us are playing army men, and this has happened before where we... One time, though, we'll never be out here.
Coleman, why do you like the Army Men thing?
Oh, I'm just messing around. I'm just messing with Coleman.
That's all he ever does.
But the other thing, I think all of us, too, in the development of the show, had been in shows where you kind of were left out there and the scene got overcooked. Whether it was in Chicago or here or whatever, so it was like, we were very aware that...
A scene can always come back.
Yeah, I mean, scenes can come back, but I mean, if you overcook it, it's done then. You can't bring it back.
What I think is interesting about you is that you came from the annoyance school.
Yes.
Most, the rest of the ensemble was from I.O. How did that differ styles when you joined Beerschot Mice?
You know, I don't know. I don't know, I don't see it as a difference, you know?
It was almost like being from a different university or a good background. It's just whatever you brought with you, whatever you had in your quiver was kind of what you brought on stage.
Other than Coleman being the funniest out of the group.
Out of everybody, that's true.
Yeah. Let's be honest. Why are you shaking your head? You remember that? Why are you shaking your head?
I forgot about that. The first rehearsal we had, it was, Coleman said, as the funniest one in the group, I just think. I guess that's the annoyance way to announce.
And then we all laugh.
Right.
We all laugh.
Okay, tell me this. How were those rehearsals? I mean, I know you guys are very competitive. You're strong personality. Who, did you bring in a coach when you first started?
We were improvising in his dining room and kitchen.
Yeah.
Dining room.
Yes.
Family room. It's ridiculous. Now, this was before Paul was in on it, but it was just ridiculous because we tried to do the format for a while, and then it was just kind of weird. And then, like Paul was saying, we started doing the tag outs. And the tagouts were just made it quick.
Well, I remember there was a scene where two people were in an office and somebody came in to deliver 7-Up to the 7-Up machine and then went through and then these people were tagged out and followed them. I remember one time Coleman was in a scene where there was three people in line for prison and Coleman was a prison guard and didn't say anything. And then everybody was tagged out except for Coleman, which was very much the unlikely choice, but why not follow him? Why do you have to follow him?
This is the funny side of the group.
Yeah.
To follow the funnies.
That's an important thing to say because in our show is that we follow the person that we don't tag out. You know, we tag everybody else out and we follow that person and character. He can't change. She can't change. Whoever it is can't change. So, Jimmy, if we're in it together and you're playing, I'm going to use another, not a butcher, let's just say a baseball player.
Okay.
You're a baseball player, always and forever.
Professional baseball player.
So if you guys are
a very good one, you're a star baseball player.
And I tag the coach. coach out and we start doing a scene, I could be your son looking up to you, but you're still a baseball player. You're not anybody else. You never change. And that's what happens with Bear Shark Mice. We just constantly follow those same people and the character all the way through.
And one of the things real quick too, and I think, I hope it's universal, but in the, whatever, 74 years we've been doing this, I've never once been tagged out and been like, I'm just gonna go into a bit about the governor. Ever. I've been tagged out every time because that's where you're supposed to be tagged out.
Great governor bits.
I'm very interested in the election coming up in 2 years. People need to know what's going on in the gubernatorial.
Now you got it.
I don't. I mean, that's what I feel. I get tagged out. I'm like, oh, I should have been tagged out.
Now, people will say.
Audience booze.
People will say that improv is a young person's game. Now, most of you are I'm not going to get late 40s. Would you say it's a fair?
At least.
I'm 30.
32. You've got a
character. Peter Holmes, 32.
Great.
I know where you're going with this, and okay. I am completely on board. I will allow you to finish your question.
Okay, thank you. How has getting older made you a better improviser?
A better improviser?
Yeah.
I think, for me, it's just experience. Just like, when I teach classes, I tell the students, like, generally, the thing that separates me from you as an improviser is experience. Because we're playing by the same rules. It's the same, like, you know, physics or calculus or whatever that makes a scene run is the same for everyone. The difference between me and you, new student, is that I just have been doing it for 25 years now. So I'm sort of, that's the big thing, just experience, and I feel like I'm just more settled in. Like, I'm really more comfortable on stage now, and I panic, I don't get nervous. I was thinking about it today that, you know, I still get as excited now as I have like for 25 years. Like, doing the show tonight, doing shows coming up with these guys, I always know. I'm really excited. I think about it all day, and I'm like, oh my gosh, I can't get to do a show tonight.
Get the butterflies.
Cool. Excited, but not nervous.
Right, exactly. Whereas when I first started, I'd be like, excited, but also kind of like, what's going to happen? But now, it's exciting. I can't wait to get out there. Can't wait to try it out. See what Neil's going to say here, what Mike's going to do, and just... the excitement.
Some of that is the approaching the Malcolm Gladwell's 10,000 hours thing.
Sure.
I don't think it's possible that any of us have improvised for 10,000 hours, but...
Explain the theory about that.
That in order to be... my crude understanding of it, I wouldn't say it exactly, but it's I believe it's Malcolm Gladwell that said the key to being expert at something is time logged doing that thing.
For sure.
No matter what it is. And he's put a line at 10,000 hours of doing something. And it's certain people, whether you're an oboe player or, you know, a sculptor, it doesn't even have to be arts, I suppose, like you, a pro baseball player.
We're pretty damn close to
that. I don't
just
know.
Just as long as you've done it. Whether we're experts or not, but I'm just saying.
It'd be hard to be somebody, it would be hard to have done it more than we have done it. Although I'm sure, you know, some people have. But my point is, though, that it's just time-logged. And actually, someone like, I don't know, Reggie Jackson, who's a Hall of Fame baseball player, who struck out more times than anybody else in Major League Baseball. He's a great player with the most failures.
Michael Jordan too. He missed more shots than anyone else. Like, that's a pretty well-known
thing. Right, because he took the most shots. Oh. So that's the same thing. We learn from our missed shots and our strikeouts, and so we're not fazed by it because we also have the most whatever.
Let me ask you this, Mike, because playing on a lot of teams over the years.
Coleman's getting a lot of questions.
Yes.
But go ahead.
Okay. How do you keep surprising these guys? Because, you know, after a while, you've been here in 12, 13 years, you play with these guys. How do you just not get in a rut and keep surprising the ensemble?
Oh my God, you're surprising.
Yeah. I know them all well and like their interests.
Right.
So if you can kind of boomerang them with something that they're into, but in a subtle way, mm-hmm. You'll see them on stage like, oh. And you're doing it to, you know, you're sincere, but you're also doing it to kind of mess with them a little bit. And that, you know, I don't know, they do it to me as well, you know.
How do you do it, Pete Holmes?
Pete and I, to supplement our acting, you know, when we're not on set, which is almost every day.
I don't know what what he's talking about.
We build stuff.
You're carpenters.
We're carpenters.
Yeah.
So we do bits, and we have different people we work with that come and go. And there's some real, real characters out here in California. So we'll just listen to them, soak it in, and then do it to each other. And Pete is an expert mimic. Like, he's very good.
Mike's pretty good, too.
But and then we do it, and then they transform into these characters that we mimic. Mm-hmm. Transform, and sometimes they show up in the show.
So this is just that we're on the outside, though. But they're going to be doing this.
No, we talk about
so
that.
So are there clicks
inside
the room?
No, it doesn't matter. If you bring it from somewhere else, it doesn't matter. But it is possible that you're doing a thing on stage that's based on a guy who you were working for that week.
Yeah,
possibly.
Or with.
We're all a character. A character choice. Anyway. You'll use it as a character.
It doesn't matter. Where you
which you would do the same thing of doing something where what you're doing. You go to a coffee shop, you see the same person. And I say that, when I teach, I always say, think of the people that you see every day. And think of the people that make you interested in them. You should, if you're interested in what they're doing and what they're all about, if they're characters, use them on stage. Don't come up with something. Remember those people
in real life. And to bring Kex into this, I remember one time Dave and I were going
there.
Dave Keckner.
I'm here.
Right. We went to some sandwich place in Chicago one time, and how you doing? Okay, I got a turkey club. Great.
Yeah, no problem.
And he gave us the thing. We sat down, and Dave was like, "Hey, bestie, yourself." I was like, "Oh yeah, okay, odd person." Sure. We didn't know each other super well, and after like the third or fourth sentence, I'm like, "Man, you believe those cops?" I'm like, "What are you doing?" He's like, "I'm doing the guy behind the counter." I didn't even think to take that guy. He was awesome. And that's the idea that you have to have. Things that happen in your everyday life, you can bring up, whether it's an emotion or a feeling. Or
can whatever. I ask you this question, because I've never asked
it personal?
There was always a rumor back in Chicago that Chris Farley stole some of your characters.
Right.
How did you respond to that?
We were very similar in the things that we had to
did you ever feel like he
true or false, Ted?
No.
True or not?
No.
You were college roommates.
Absolutely,
so
yeah.
You shared a sense of humor.
Yeah, rugby together, yeah. Marquette.
Yes.
You guys are good buddies.
Yes, yeah. Yeah, so we had similar things and encounters to draw things from. I mean, he's doing a motivational speaker with Bob Odenkirk Road. That's Larry Hill, old rugby buddy of ours, and his dad, mm-hmm. in a combo. Although one time at SNL, he went to SNL and he came back, and I had a bit where... I literally came into like a meeting or something like this, and I fell. I wasn't like being funny. I fell, and I kind of got up, and I was like, "Hey, where'd you guys go after you threw me in the puddle?" And I got a huge laugh. Whatever I did, and so I'm talking to Chris after we came home from his first hiatus at SNL, and I'm like, "How's it going?" He goes, "Oh, it's great. Oh man, I want to tell you." You know that puddle bit? I used it. Lauren thought it was hilarious. But he was very genuine about it because I didn't know what else to say. He's
pretty good mimic.
The writers were like, "Hey, you're really late for a big meeting," and then it turned out to be Lauren and all of the executives. It's kind of like a prank he would do on the rookie. And he went in and everyone stared at him because he wasn't supposed to be there, and it was a very rude interruption. And he fell across these chairs and said that, and they got a huge laugh. It was like, "I just said that, so don't do it if you're there." Which was nothing. No, I was like, "Oh, thanks, man, because I would have
stole your bit." Don't do it.
But to your answer, no. I mean, we, kind of.
Because I would have had no problem with that. So we're gonna do a beer shark mice.
What?
Yes. Yeah.
All right.
Okay. Can I answer this? Is this curmudgeonly stuff that Neil does? Is that him really, or is this part of an act?
It's both.
Okay.
That's what, even that, like him talking about him and Chris Farley, we do the same thing to each other,
uh-huh.
We will steal things from each other. Like Mike was saying, we'll give each other garbage on stage, not garbage, but we play with each other in the sense of being playful, stealing things, or making them do it we know they can do, because we love it so much,
What do you mean curmudgeon?
There's no less this like curmudgeon-y kind of act.
Old man flip.
Yeah. Is that an act, or is that really you, do you think?
It's an act. Yeah. It's a nice it's me playing around. I'm not okay. actually agitated. Okay. But I would like to get off my lawn.
Okay. So what are we going to do? I'll take the suggestion and we need, what do we start with?
A location.
Okay.
Graduated from carts?
Yep.
How am I facing and carts?
Yep.
This is ridiculous.
Yep.
Are you in, she's the shift manager, and suddenly someone's the king of the shift. Is that what this is about?
I think it's about the quality of the work.
Yeah?
Yep.
On hours or after hours?
Take it easy, dirty diaper.
What?
Smells like jealousy. Baby jealousy. I'm not baby food.
I've been here 3 months longer than you, and I'm still on facing in and out on cart.
Move over soup.
Aisle 2. On the left hand side, all the way in. On the bottom.
There's also gourmet soup on aisle 1.
Yeah?
Yep. It's delicious.
It's more expensive, though.
It is, but it's worth it. If you only have one soup, go for it.
Can I ask you for a high five?
I'll rock a high five with you. Yeah.
And Warhol paying
it out. Who needs you?
Maybe you're right. Maybe it's my work. Damn it. I can't lie to you. I took a class.
You took a class?
Yeah.
Okay, listen. Here at changing your workspace, right? The better, okay? What you gotta do is you gotta get in there, right? You gotta put your game face on and start changing up. So say, let's role play, all right? I'm your boss. Okay? And I'm gonna tell you to do something. You change it out. Do something else. Hey, I'm gonna put these Starbursts next to these $1,000 bars.
I'm gonna clean the bathroom.
What?
The bathroom's filthy.
Yeah, but I mean, change it here. Change it here.
Too far. I'm gonna put my apron on from work.
Okay, great. Is that gonna help you?
Yes.
Get you into your space and your. Okay. Yeah.
3 years.
Put the fake mustache on? Go on.
Oh, that's just for the kids. The kids can be done.
Oh, put it on.
Okay.
Put it on. There we go.
All right, here we go.
All right. How does that feel?
It's okay. It's lost some of its gum.
Totally different.
Right?
Are you married? Are you married?
I'm not. I'm not single.
Wow. I think you're going to pick somebody up with that.
All right, here we go. All right. Hey, look at this. This macaroni and cheese is going to be right next to these soup cans.
I want to thank you for... Wow. I know. My son Benjamin said the man with the mustache was wonderful, and I can see why.
Why do you have a kid on a goddamn leash?
Watch the language.
Bill, why do you have a kid on a leash?
Watch the language.
Raising children is difficult. I think we're all aware of that, yes? Okay. Raising a porcupine is difficult. Raising an alligator is difficult.
I've never raised an alligator.
Exactly. That'll be $500.
This is the first day of school, and yeah. You can just give me the leash, and I'll take
okay, great.
Your child.
Okay. So he gets an A, or how does that work?
Sure, he'll get an A. I'll just tie him up here.
Okay,
that'd be perfect. You can come back and pick him up at 3 o'clock.
I actually was to see a movie. So we're down around 6.
Well, class ends at 3.
It's not that
okay. Well, as a principal,
no, please.
As a principal, I don't like to get into the classroom. But I like to let you guys do your thing,
right?
And I do mine,
right?
Your thing's down. You're my face, sort of like the umbrella, right? You know me. I'm hands off.
Yeah, I know.
I'm like, you're teaching, you teach.
Yes,
right?
Yeah. This is a Waldorf.
That's right. So I was walking by your classroom the other day, and just I gotta say, it looks like a doggy daycare. Tom, what's going on?
I'm not a good disciplinarian. So I told the parents to put their children on a leash and then I tie them to a chair. That way they won't eat paste.
Wow. So you forcibly tie the children down? I don't know what to tie. You tie the children down, Tom?
You told my kid, if you really want to know another kid, snip his butt. Yes. You admit that?
I did. And then I gave him a milk bone as a treat.
I understand. I will give you like this much room that a kid, some kid out of line might be on a leash or something. But you've gone way too far.
Have you seen
milk bone?
Yes.
Go ahead. Have I seen what?
Your child's math scores. They've improved since they've been in my class.
You tell me how that matches up. Treat a kid like a dog and he'll learn how to do complicated math. Does it actually work?
Yes.
Has his scores actually gone up?
Yes.
Who's paper dad?
What's 15 times 5?
Yep. Gonna hit the yard? Got a ball. Look. Look at this ball. Look at it. Look at it. Look at it. Look at the ball. Look at the ball. Look at the ball.
It's good. Okay. You know what? I got something for you, and I don't want you to take offense.
Is it food? It's all food.
No. I'm going to set these down. You know. It's just a thing because I don't want you running around. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Oh, I love it.
Just wait, you know what a perimeter is?
Like
a boundary.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Right.
So if you, I'd like you to say honor. Robert.
Sure.
And if you go beyond that, you may regret it.
Right.
Hey, it's Robert out of the Inch.
Let's go. Let's go candy shop.
Smell that?
Is this candy shop nearby?
Hey, you guys, you're waiting at the candy shop. What the hell?
We love the candy shop.
I love candy too. We love you two, too.
That's so funny. They're so cute.
Oh my gosh.
I know.
Well, come on.
All right, let's go.
Roy!
Yeah.
Learn! Learn, boy! Learn!
It's actually weird.
Why is his neck smoking?
He's got a scarf, but he's getting small scarf. It could be hot later.
Yeah.
He just likes to sing his voice.
Sure. Wait. I saw this in Indiana once.
What?
He's being punished.
How?
Punished?
They punish people in Indiana?
Yes. A lot. They learn how to spell words, but not really. They spell cat with a K. Mm-hmm.
I will take it off my Pacers jersey.
I thought that's how you spell cat.
That's not. That's a phonetic spelling.
Oh.
Girls? Your father is, father's picking you up at school. I just have to open the old car there.
We missed your old car.
Well, your mother got the divorce.
I get the front seat.
You know what?
It's a switcheroo, because I had Trump this morning.
Whatever. I get it now.
Okay. That's good.
I won't put a lot of gum in your hair.
Trudy, shut up. You just sit in the back seat without a seat.
Mom got that, too.
Yes, she did.
Along with Dad's feelings.
Why did Mom leave you?
She was cheating on me.
Could you tell us the story when...
I'm tired of you. Because you're not big and strong and powerful.
I'll meet you in the hot tub, all right, baby?
Okay, break.
Okay.
Me too.
Hey, what's that?
Wait, wait up.
You're crazy!
Don't forget your massage.
I won't.
What's up, champ?
See, they're manly, not like you.
How could you do this in front of me? Just flirting those guys right in front of me.
What are you gonna do about it? Add numbers together and get a diploma? Those guys are like, who cares about knowing things? Let's hurt someone.
Carol, right now.
Break something. Break art. Let's break art, they say.
Carol, if you break art, you have to pay for it, okay? And I can't deduct that on our taxes.
Oh my God. This is why I'm leaving.
That looks nice.
Yeah.
Bring me a brewski.
Yeah.
What?
Sasha looks nice, man.
All right, I'm jumping in.
Whoa. Yeah. All right.
Wow. Here you go, guys.
Damn. Stroh 30 pack. I haven't seen those in a while.
Oh, the dudes.
I went raw in here. I'm raw under this water.
What do you guys say, huh? You guys want to play hot potato?
Sure.
Hold on.
It looks like something else.
What? What are you talking about? What does it look like? What does it look like? Like I got like a crazy hamster in my hand?
Yeah, crazy hamster.
I've heard about you, right?
Hi, welcome to Game World. I had no fantasies. You kind of looking for some fun, frolicky underwater?
Yeah, actually we were
underwater for a big all?
Yeah. Play that underwater?
You can. It's a small whirlpool.
That's exactly what we're in a hot tub.
Right. That's cool. That's where your bed is. It's not a hot tub.
Yeah.
I assume.
Kind of receding a little bit.
You are?
I was.
Wow, now you are.
I got plugs put in there, so.
That's cool. You can draw like bangs out of the headband, so it looks like a.
You know what? My girlfriend, she stitches like hair inside the bandana, so it's just hanging down.
Right. Oh,
and then I put it on, it looks like I got a lot of hair.
Like you got bangs.
Right.
She's so pretty.
All right, let's go to Bon Jovi. I'm waiting.
Oh, sorry, baby.
I'm still a lady.
In there, buddy. Look.
Save it!
Alright!
John might see me! Whoa!
Look, I got your picture hanging down, dangling from my mirror.
So sweet.
Where are my keys? They're in your pocket? Ah!
When we first met, I slapped your face.
What?
When we first met, I would have slapped your face.
You mean when we went to prom together, baby?
No, turnabout. I asked you out. You always forget about that.
Sorry.
You were by your locker. You were looking sad. I tapped on your shoulder.
Madeline, you've got to ask someone. You're going to be the only girl not at turnabout.
I don't have to go to these patriarchal events.
Turnabout is the opposite of a patriarchal event. It's a gynecological event.
They're making us do it.
What's up, Frank?
Layers on layers.
Hey, you. I can't remember my combination.
Look, I gotta get the algebra.
Four. Just the letter? Five. No number. Right.
Hey, Frank.
Right. Hey.
Right. They call me Frank.
What? My name's Frank.
Okay, Frank.
Talk to me.
And would you like to go to a dance?
Oh my gosh. Oh my gosh.
I think you just pooped in your pants.
No, I didn't.
You can get back to me. I mean, it's only in a couple days.
Can I call you?
Sure.
What's your name? Oh. I've never watched that shit.
Frank, I did everything wrong.
What?
I did everything wrong.
Did you?
Yes. With women, with money, with my life, with the dead body.
All right, yes.
improv.
I don't think I'm clear with the lights that the tape come on. So I just had to edit ourselves because we were going about 15 or 20. Let's break that down for just a second. The first run of characters was the, who was in the first scene?
Me and Mike.
Okay.
Guys in the supermarket.
Supermarket.
Yeah.
Okay, and how? Who was the first tag out in that?
It was Pete's class, because Mike said he took a class and Pete was the teacher of that class.
When
Neil came in and entered as somebody to hype his character.
I
was just approving of Mike's character and disapproving of Paul's, is all.
Okay.
Just giving it more, you know, making
so
it.
So what were you guys hiding?
Just that we knew more about Mike, and you know, we could have gone Mike or Paul.
Right. Uh-huh.
But in this case, it was to Mike and making Mike a more fruitful character, even more so. You know, just basically giving a gift of
Mike's a high status guy already, so Neil's like hiding his status more and sort of consequently lowering my status more.
Great. And, you know, I mean, a longer show, we'd probably have that scene go on a little bit longer to find out who exactly who they are more, but we'd always go back to them from time to time. We also found out that that when Mike found out that the soup cans were in one location or another, when he said he took a class to do that, I just thought that, like, we should go see that class right away. And that's why I tagged in and did that. To find out how ridiculous you should have a soup section in one, first in the aisle one and then one in aisle four, I think.
So
when you guys go out, you always have a premise in mind? Or some sort of initiative?
You mean if you tag someone out?
If you tag someone out.
Yes. Okay. And the person who is left, the person who is not tagged out and is waiting because they remain on the stage and you have tagged their partner out, they know you are going to let them know what's going on and why you're there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's usually heightening their game, like one person's game. Like in the first one, like my game was that I was a sort of low status guy and Mike was a high status guy, so Neil just heightened that game. And it's not necessarily
just crossing through. No.
Yeah. 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 Not necessarily a premise per se, but like playing the game in an
adding ambiance to the movie.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, I'm sure. What was the boss of you guys? The girl's name?
Betsy.
Betsy. Yeah. So Betsy would have come in eventually, possibly.
Right.
What we try to do when we do our show is get some things established in that first scene. In this case, like Pete said, it was an abbreviated version,
right.
So the first scene was very short. But what we try to do is learn something about both characters, if for no other reason, to give us a choice of which one to follow. But also, if that other one that was not followed ever comes back, we know something about that character. And two, most of the time, a good percentage of the time, the first tag out that takes place is not a permanent spiral away from that scene. Like Pete tagged out and he's teaching him a class, very likely what happens next is Paul comes back, takes Pete out, and they're back at the supermarket, but now we know a little bit more background.
About at least 10.
And they continue that first scene.
But then we also have more ammo because now we've got a teacher. And 10 minutes later, somebody might say, I don't know, I took a class in you know, fixing cars, and boom, it's the same guy. Okay, fixing cars, we got a tire right here. What are we gonna put next to it? You know, so it's, you know, one of the things of our show is we try not to lose anything that we've kind of created on the stage. You know what I mean? So once Pete's been created, we'd love to bring him back into the mix, as opposed to you go away whenever you see him. We'd love to see everybody come back as much as we can.
I was at some point going to do something with a $1,000 bar. Did anyone notice that?
Right.
You accidentally said the candy bar is $1,000, but yeah, instead of $100,000.
They love my mistakes. Beer Shark, my dojo, they
big
love
profit.
Not only my mistakes, which I tend to do a lot more than that, but we love the mistakes because the mistakes is a true improv choice. It's a mistake. We know
it's an absolute gift. If she makes a mistake.
But wasn't Dell big on that that's where the magic lied, was when you made a mistake?
Because it's nothing more real. I mean, that literally could have been.
You have to react.
Half of the show could have been, all right, fellas, look, we got to cut back. Everyone's cutting back.
That's exactly.
$10,000.
It's great.
Up. Let me make it smaller.
$1,000.
But we end up always, I mean, it is never not a choice to follow whatever mistake it is.
Yeah.
Ever in Beer Shark Mice. And it's just
blossoms. If somebody says something wrong or somebody swallows it the wrong way and gets a word out kind of strange, boom, we're on it. Yeah. Somebody's saying something about it because...
It pretty much always pays off to follow.
Always. It never does. Young improvisers should always do that.
That's the one thing that surprises everyone. Because the person who made the mistake didn't mean to make it.
Yes.
So it's organic to them and everyone else. So now we're all really in that same discovery moment together.
Right. Something is true accidentally that wasn't true a moment before.
Yes. And they're all sheerly in that moment of discovery. Because the person who said it wrong didn't mean to say it wrong. So they're discovering it and we're all discovering it too. And that's like where you sort of jump off something. You're like, oh, wow. And that, like Del said, just like you're in free fall. Like,
well, so what is the difference between a rookie, not a more experienced player like you guys, capitalizing on a mistake?
Well, one of the things, first of all, Pete said, $1,000 bar. When we're on the sides, on the wings here, we're just like the audience. We're listening to everything. And you can never once have we sat there and gone, okay, I'm going to come back as a snowman. You bring those leashes back, and we're going to, you know, whatever. It's like, I can't. Because every time if I turn to say anything to him, I've just missed $1,000 bar. So, if we hear it, the audience heard it, like Neil said, it's the first truism
of all of us
collectively. And you can't make it up. You can't be like, I'm going to say something silly here. No. Pete was clearly trying to go $100,000 bar, and he didn't. But that's okay.
No, it was a choice.
A lot of times new improvisers will have a tendency to normalize the scene. And like if something like off kilter happens, they'll sort of bring it back to normal. Give me $100,000 bar. And people say, yeah, yeah. And then all of a sudden that gift is like squelched, just normalized again, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right, because you're afraid it was a mistake.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
So you go inside,
you run from it instead of, or try to correct it instead of embracing it.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
Okay, we've got some time for some questions. Oh. We some people are here to ask questions.
I don't get it at all. I don't get anything.
Actually, the audience is going to, Matt, the audience will ask you questions. I wasn't clear on that. Like I wasn't clear on the light. We could just, who's got a question for Beer Shark Mice? Yeah, right here.
Can we just go down the line and say how many years it took before you could say, I was a good improviser?
Okay, that's a fair question. When did you feel like, I'm really good at this?
Oh gosh, I still have doubts. Sure.
Okay.
I feel like it's a constant learning process.
I agree.
But I feel more comfortable. It probably took me 12 or so years till I really felt comfortable.
Pete?
That's a good question. I remember because my teachers, when I first started doing improv, and I was doing it at Columbia College and Second City and Improv Olympic and Improv Institute, I was everywhere, Annoyance Theater. And after a while, they were like going, some of my teachers at Second City were like, Pete, you should just stick with just straight acting. You're more of an actor. You're not good at this at all. They did not think I was a good improv.
How did you get over that?
I think something like that for me made me push even harder to learn. I would watch all the good teams, and the people that I thought were really funny, I would watch them. I would sit there and just dissect everything they did, and then after a while, when you get the confidence to go out there and be whatever you like to do as an improviser, me, I'm physical. I like doing characters. I just did it, and then once I did that and owned that, that's when I started learning to improvise a lot, because I had faith in myself. So, to answer your question, I don't know.
Neil, what about yours?
Mine's going to come out different, and kind of, this may come out making me not look like a very humble guy, but I was older, like when Pete or you guys finally got there and felt good, I was probably that age the first time I improvised. I was over 30 before I ever tried it.
But you also came from an acting background.
Right. I had been an actor, and then the idea of improvising terrified me. I wouldn't go anywhere near it.
I was a serious actor, too.
Yeah. And still are. Very serious. So I had gone out here and lived for a few years in L.A. and gone back to Chicago, and so I was a little kind of, not exactly fearless, but I wasn't intimidated by much.
Can I ask you, this was a rumor about you, can you open it up to me? There was a rumor.
I've heard legend to rumor.
Okay. That when you were out of L.A. the first time, that you were very close to getting a co-starring role on Coach before you came back to Chicago to study.
It's funny that that would even be known, because it was, but no, I did audition for, there's a character named Dauber, like the big,
right, yeah,
dumb guy, yeah. Coach, because I'm, you know, taller than average. It's like, yeah, he could be the dumb football player. I did not come close at all to getting it.
Okay.
At the first audition, she said, and it was good advice. And again, I had never done comedy at that point. The casting director said, come here. I can tell you can act. You're a good actor. But this is a sitcom. And I was kind of doing it like, you know, Boo Radley meets Lenny from Mice and Men. You know? I gave a heart-wrenching performance as an offer on the pilot of Coach. And so it was an important thing to learn, that it's like I had the capability of being funny, but no experience doing it. And so not long after, when I came back to Chicago,
when did you come back to Chicago? For improv?
No, God, no. I came because I failed utterly out here.
Okay.
And it was time, and I didn't quit, I just retreated.
And that's when we met.
Went back to Chicago.
When he came back?
Yes. Right.
Thinner, how about you? When did you feel like?
Probably 14.
14 years?
No, 14 years old.
Okay. You were a prodigy.
Thank you. Well, you know.
Yeah.
Kind of like Mike, I don't ever feel like, I mean, I feel like with this group, it's quite a safety net to have, whereas you could be in a scene and perhaps not have an idea or maybe be struggling a little bit, that you know you're pretty well surrounded. But to me, improv is like golf in a weird way, that you might have a great hole or a great back nine, but you're really never going to have 18 holes in one. So you're always trying to get a better game in. And this is kind of the same. You might have a great scene or a great character or a great show, but to extend that to 18 shows in a row is a lot to do.
I've said that before. That's what keeps you honest about this. Is you, if you just, as they say, throw your jock out there and expect to win the game, you will fail and you will be humbled and embarrassed. Because even if you're very good, if you take it for granted, you will fail. And it takes the effort, and you have to put. Go back. I mean,
put 14.
Sorry.
14
years old. 14.
I would say, I think Mike's got a pretty good gauge on like 12 years, but it's also sort of like different times. Like when I was in college, I joined an improv group and I didn't feel like I was very good, but then by the time I graduated, I was like, oh, I'm sort of getting the handle of this, I got this. And then I went on to something else, and then you're sort of a beginner again, and you sort of like learn, you sort of get comfortable with that. And then like, and then I went to Second City, I sort of worked through their class. I felt, well, beginner, and then I worked and worked and worked, felt better. And then I got to I.O., start all over again, you know? But I would say maybe 10 years. And that kind of thing, where you go from like questioning like how's it going to go to I think this is going to be okay.
I think you also get better when you get with the right people that you know and you click with.
Yes.
Right? Yeah.
Like Sharna used to put teams together.
Sharna helped run in the improv. Olympics.
We don't have to say her last name.
Well, but not everyone who listens to the podcast knows who she is.
Sorry.
Okay.
Anyways, I will say Sharna's my improv mother. There.
Okay.
All right. So, but Sharna would just put teams together. A heavyset guy, a pretty woman, a short guy who's crazy, a tall guy who's smart, a kind of frumpy girl, and that's how she used to put her teams together. It was
did
just,
she really?
Yes, she did.
By time
was an actual formula?
I'm all positive.
Where did you get that?
I'm all positive. Don't worry about it.
But I just want to verify the source.
But Pete and I were rarely on teams together. And that was one of the neat things.
But I was much younger than you, Pat.
I was probably.
Why would I be? Do you think that's because Sharna figured you were both the same type and therefore you didn't belong on the same team?
No, but you were. No. You were better than I was when I first started.
Well, but you started at the I.O.
Way behind. Yeah.
Way behind. You were like a generation behind.
Yes, that's what I mean. Like, you guys are way ahead of me. Well, I'm not.
I'll agree with Pete. Like, I think getting with the right people, you sort of learn a ton, because I was on a team at I.O. that was doing pretty well, but then one day I got this break to perform with the family doing Dynamite Fun Nest, and that was like a whole new universe opened up. Like, that was like going to the majors for me. Like, that was going to the majors. I learned a ton super, super fast from doing that show.
Okay, we got time for a couple more questions. Yes.
Oh. I'm wondering, what makes one want to be an improviser in the first place?
I think anytime someone, like say we have an audience of say 100 people that watch this show, but not this show, but a show, I always think that let's say 30% of the people will never see another improv show. 60% of the people would say, that was fine, that was good, I liked that. And 10% of the people will say, I want to do that. Maybe lower than 10. but a certain amount of audience members will always say, I'm intrigued, what is that? I want to be involved.
Yeah, I'll totally attest to that, because when I was in college, my friend dragged me to my first improv show that he was doing with some other guys, and I saw, they did a Herald, oddly enough, and I saw that show, and it struck such a profound chord inside of me, like watching these guys do this Herald. I was like, literally said out loud to myself, that's what I'm going to do with the rest of my life. And it was like, no question, it was like everything else dropped away, and basically altered the course of my life, and that was a star that I navigated from that moment to this. Is an exactly straight line.
That's what it is. Like, and same with me. It's like I saw a Second City show, and I didn't care for the scenes as much as the improv, because the improv was just, it was right there, they were making it up, and you could tell they were enjoying it, they were having fun, it was play. And like, when we do this, we always call it, it's not just us showing up and just improvising together, we always call it like a bowling night, because bowling nights are fun. You're out, you're on a few beers, you're with your buddies, your gals, and you're just bowling, and you're laughing, and you're having a good time. And that's basically why it's so much fun. You know?
Now, knowing you guys, you're all very competitive people, all very strong personalities. We're in LA where people get stuff in TV, films, and how do you deal with other people's successes, and how do you bring that to the group?
I think if you, I think you leave it at the door, relative success in the business. It's not going to fly if you change your tune compared to what job you've gotten.
I think all of us hope that any of us do well in a collective mind. I mean, I think anybody, you know, we can all go up for the same part, and there's not competition with us. What we do in the room is different than, you know, what Mike's going to do, what Paul's going to do, everybody's going to be different. So in that sense, you're competitive in that you want a job, but it's not against these guys. For me, it's not. So I want everyone to do well. That means that somehow this group mind or this village that we came from is producing some people that are doing really good things, and that's a good thing.
And I'll sort of circle back to something you said earlier, that you said it's kind of like golf, or it's kind of like any sport where it doesn't matter like what you are off the court or off the course. Right. When you're there, it's a pure sort of thing. And if you take it for granted, if you think, oh, my star quality is going to get me laughs no matter what, that's when it's going to get put down your throat. You'd be like, oh, fuck.
That happened every time any big celebrity came to Chicago.
Yeah.
Went to Second City to perform with the resident house team at Second City, and they'd go up and do the improv set, and everybody would be there going, hey, I hear you, and the rumor would go around, hey, Jim Belushi's here, Jim Belushi's gonna be on the, and he'd go out there and go, hey, fuck this, and then all of a sudden everybody would just be looking at him, and no laughs at all. Yeah. And it was like, and then guys that we know would go out and do something, and just brilliant improv moves, and they get a huge laugh, because they were playing, they weren't just working off there.
There's also, not to over, glorify it or anything, but there's a code of conduct, an ethical code, I think, that goes on among the best players. In the same way that, you go with golf again, if you're in the woods and touch your ball, you have to be honest and say, I hit the ball, that's one stroke against me. You have to obey the rules.
Yeah.
And it's the same thing here. Like, people will often say, so how many times do you do the same sort of bit or roll of jokes or something, and your answer is never, and they don't believe you, but it's never, unless it's an accident, when you repeat a joke or a character or a bit, because that's against the code of conduct. You don't go to anything that you know will work or suspect will work. It's always on the fly, unrepeated, if you can possibly help it, because that's the purity that you're hoping for.
I want to end with this question, because I know a lot of people that listen to this podcast want to know the answer. When you're doing a show on TV or a movie, how much can you improvise on the set?
I would say most of the time, never.
Now that's, you're speaking for the middle and Scrubs?
On Scrubs, I got to offer alternate lives. But if you're hired for a job, if it's your job and you're there every week or whatever, then you work it out. You might be able to do that. But if you're hired to do an appearance on some job, you better feel out pretty quickly what the rules are before you start improvising with the writer's lines.
How about Marvin?
That's, I've been lucky in that sense. And most of the things that I've done, Ed, Seinfeld, Marvin, all that kind of stuff, that's word for word. Now, if you can come up with something maybe as an alternate on a third take, and you feel risky, you can try that. And that's okay if you can feel the environment out. I can tell you that a lot of times improv will help in the room to get you the job. Also in commercials, I feel that improv is huge, and it's a pretty big thing to have in your hip pocket. And anything you do, if you have improv, it's you're walking in there with something that most people don't have. But Marvin, I'm lucky in that I work with these guys that have kind of, after the second or third, first episode, they were kind of, I was kind of, hey, what if this happened? And they were like, oh my gosh, yeah, say it. And they'll come over and let me say other things. And I come up with things like, hey, what if so-and-so, the other character said that? I'm not even in the scene, but I'll throw it out. But it's, to me, something I learned actually on Seinfeld, where Julia Louis-Dreyfus set me up on a joke because I was doing something to make Jerry laugh.
The male character.
Yeah, yeah. And Andy Ackerman said, hey, dude, make Jerry laugh in the scene. And it was a run-through. So I did this bit, and it made Jerry laugh. So then we're taping it, and I didn't do it. And he goes, hey, what happened to that bit? I go, I was just trying to make Jerry laugh. And he goes, no, make the whole country laugh. That's a cool bit. And then Julia came over, and she goes, I'm setting you up in this next scene. Like, oh, we got to go to Joe Mayo's house and show me what you're doing. You know, which was pointing my fingers, and she goes, then I'll do it in the bit before yours to set you up, literally lobbing it up. She's getting no laugh out of it, no mileage at all, which was a really cool thing for her to do, but it was a testament to that show. And anyway, she set me up, I set it in thing, and we had to wait forever for laughs just because she had set me up so well for it. So in that case, it can, but I would say part and parcel, it's not really well, you don't.
If you don't know the rules of that production, don't show up.
Oh, no.
Say
yeah.
Never.
No.
You.
Especially for pilots. And it took me a while to like to be like, I'll just throw one of my own in there. It's like so many notes have been given to these writers, and they've gone back and worked on it, and they've had meetings and notes over the phone and notes in person. You need to respect all the work they've put
in. So when you go for a pilot audition, you go word to word, you don't?
Yeah, and be very prepared, because they're prepared. They put months and months of work into it, and notes, and up all night, and, you know, like, arguing, and, you know, they've really put a lot into it. And, you know, you're going to come in and jack around.
But I think you can button it, you know what I mean?
Explain what a button is.
Button at the end of it. You know, you haven't touched what they've written. You've done the scene the way they wrote it, and then at the end you may button it with something funny that you think that character would say at the end.
And you're doing that for
just a line. You're not going on another monologue. Right. Just something to so just show them that, hey, I'm pretty funny, and here's
and they'll remember you that by then.
Well, they could remember you.
Okay. And you might get a laugh.
You could get a laugh from it, and they might go, wow, that was pretty funny. Wow, we didn't even think about that with that character.
But I would say the shorter the better.
Yes, make it short.
Reaction, a look, a verbalization, something that just kind of buds it rather than a comment or a sentence,
right.
Or God forbid a speech.
I mean, the show that Mike was on with the factory, that was an improvised-based
yes.
show.
Yeah,
and then they built
different.
Around it.
Yes.
Same with American Body Shop. It was the same thing. It was like you would improvise a little bit, but the writer still wrote something, and they would let you play around with it. But always, almost 9 times out of 10, even on any of these sitcoms, The Office and that, like Pat said, you would do 3, 4, 5, 6 takes, and maybe at the end, if the director's cool enough, he may go, all right, play it, loosen it up.
You just did an Office. How was that? Did you get to do stuff at the end?
We did at the end after we did it like 8, 9 times, and then all of a sudden they were like, all right, throw something in there. And then you got to feel it out, you know? I mean, being as long in the show, I mean, in the business as I have, then I was like, hell, I'm going to say something that I think is funny that this character would say. And
slow-mo,
you
know, fighting?
Whether they use it. I invented slow-mo fighting, just so you know. But, I mean, you should be able to throw it in there. And, you know, it's probably going to end up on the editing room floor, but at least you threw your 2 cents.
Yeah.
Go.
I did a quick pilot audition. It was like to the end with the star of his pilot, and we're doing it, and everyone's 40 people standing there, and they go, he goes, hey, let's just mess around, let's fuck around, just have fun. I'm like, oh, okay. And I thought, well, the handcuffs are off, let's go. And so he went off his line, and my next line was, there you are, you know, without any pants. And I go, and there you are, sans pants, you know, hanging around. And he just goes, what are you talking about? What did you say sans for? It's not in the script. And I'm like, hey, what do you mean? What script are you talking about? Trying to sit in. And literally, everyone's like, get out. Yeah, get out.
He had already drifted from the script?
Yeah, he already did. But he said to me, let's fuck around.
Right.
And then he went off script.
One word.
Who was it?
I'm not going to say it.
Don't take him again.
Look at Jim. Who was it?
Do you think he was doing it just a sample?
I don't know. I
say yes.
Yes, I say yes.
I say yes.
But it was such a horrible thing. I was
I'll find out later.
It's like, we should eat the candy. Okay. He's eating the candy.
Great. We got to go.
I'm going to say 13. Sorry, 13 and a half.
I thought you were going to say
episode 56 of Improv Nerd, if you're counting. We're moving on to 57, if you like it or not. I want to thank our guests today, all the members of Beer Shark Mice, as well as James Grace for being such a gracious host at IO West in Los Angeles, as well as Dustin Marshall for recording this, and Ben Caprero, my producer, in Chicago. You've probably figured this one out already on your own, but we are on feralaudio.com, and we are among some great other podcasts like Chelsea Peretti has one, Matt Dwyer, Todd Barry, Dan Harmon, Brain Warp, The Baby Eater, so check us out on feralaudio.com. And if you like what we do, hit that donate button and see what happens. I'm waiting to see what happens. If you want more information about me, Jimmy Corain, and my award-winning classes, The Artist Low Comedy, and my Improv Nerd blog, go to jimmycorain.com. And like us on Facebook, Improv Nerd Facebook page. It really helps with my low self-esteem. Thanks for all your great emails. It keeps us going. And until next time, remember, walk, don't run. Jimmy's a nerd, he's a nerd. Oh, yeah. Jimmy's a nerd, he's a
nerd. Let's say Seinfeld was on an island, yeah, and he was blowing Boris Karloff. What would that be like?
It might go something like this. Oh, Mr. Karloff, I loved you in Frankenstein, and I love giving you a blowjob. Why, Mr. Seinfeld, I love having you